Many analysts say there's no doubt that it will, but that's not a bad thing, as NATO is driven by an aggressive US foreign policy, they suggest. Foreign and defence ministers are in the process of creating an EU army. They say the conflict in Ukraine proves the importance of such a move. When opinion polls are carried out, most citizens always agree they don't want more money being spent on war machines.
The more we put and focus energy on something wrong like war, you know, it increases the chance that war is coming to us.
I just think it's to make the people feel safe, but I don't really think it will change anything, so I think they should spend money on something different.
There is also resistance to the huge amounts of money being spent by the 30 countries that make up the NATO military alliance.
My party and my political friends, we want that Germany goes out of NATO. We want to bring Russia into Europe because Russia is a part of Europe and the United States are far from Europe.
NATO and EU leaders will hold summits later this week here in the Belgian capital. Peace activists are calling for greater diplomatic efforts by them to end the bloodshed in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colourful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glassy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity marking the first day of spring and the renewal of nature. Nowruz, a legacy from thousands of years ago, always energizes people celebrating the event to observe many customs.
Nowruz promotes values of peace and solidarity within families and across generations. It is believed to be a key contributor to cultural diversity and friendship among different communities.
Days before the arrival of Nowruz, Iranians hastily do backlogs and go shopping to embrace the turn of the Persian year, with a lot of ceremonial customs waiting to be observed. Iranians get prepared for Nowruz by cleaning their house, a custom known as Khana Tekani. Dusting and cleaning home appliances and furniture, washing rugs and etc. are just parts of the house cleaning process. Moreover, the Nowruz festivity has a symbolic item unique to this tradition, Sofeya Haftsin. The hefts spread include 7 items, all starting with the letter seen in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there is a history behind each element, including sirke, or vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality. Somek is a symbol of love and compassion. Sib, or apple, is said to represent health and fertility. Sanjad, or silver berry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection. Sabze, or sprout, symbolizes rebirth. Sir, or garlic, is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction. And samanu represents affluence.
Iranians spend the night of Nowruz with their family. The traditional New Year dinner is fish with rice and herbs. Many families give a money gift called Eidi to the children to mark the New Year. People often visit each other's homes and always bring traditional gifts.
Nowruz provides a good opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz has been regarded as the feast of unification. The celebration of Nowruz needs a happy ending to make it perfect. So on the last day of this celebration, people go outdoors to celebrate the end of the Nowruz holidays. The last day of Nowruz holidays is called Sizdabedar, or 13 Day Out, which is also called Nature's Day.
Nowruz is a time for family and friends to gather and celebrate the end of one year and the beginning of the next. Preparing for Nowruz starts a few weeks before the new year with the traditional spring cleaning of the home. At this time, it is also customary to purchase new clothing and new furniture for the home.
In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz as an international event at the initiative of several countries that share this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. It is now widely known to be a symbol of peace to many people.
Nowruz is reminiscent of renewal and a new life. It's something beyond a mere festival. It's a culture which introduces a human civilization. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Refugees are welcome here. The most popular chant at today's protest. Thousands gathered outside the BBC over the weekend, disappointed yet again by the way Western governments are treating people fleeing war and persecution.
People here today say that the British population is being brainwashed by a racist state-funded media. That's probably why today's protest is being held outside the BBC. They want to know why Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed, but refugees from almost anywhere else will soon be branded criminals.
The UK has issued 4,000 visas for Ukrainians with family in Britain, and anyone with a spare room is being offered £350 a month to house those without family here. They can stay for 3 years, they can work, and will have access to public services, including the National Health Service. Meanwhile, the government is pushing through the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill that could see refugees from elsewhere arriving via routes like the English Channel get up to 4 years in prison.
I feel like we're forgetting that other people are still fighting to be like considered as worthy of empathy. And we need to keep thinking about people in Palestine, in Yemen, and, you know, all the previous refugees that came to the UK, for instance, that were not treated as well, like the Syrian refugees. And for me, I think this is what today is about, to remember that we're all humans and we all deserve to be treated the same way.
Protests like these attract people campaigning for various causes, all of them somehow related to the persecution of minorities and racism.
I've been a supporter of Stand Up to Racism for many years. I grew up in apartheid South Africa and left the country because of the apartheid situation and came to England and did my education here. And I am very sympathetic to refugees. I'm appalled that we don't have, as a formerly Christian country in this country, a more open and welcoming view on refugees.
We are not against antisemitism. We are against the violent action of being to our kids in Gaza, and we are totally supporting Jewish people, and we are totally supporting anyone who is decent to others and peaceful to others.
Before hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees mobilized, the UK insisted its public services are at breaking point. Tabloid newspapers encouraged millions to vote for Brexit in 2016, creating the illusion that Britain was being overrun by foreigners. But the media is now sending a very different message. It seems the NHS can cope, and Ukrainian refugees will not be taking any British jobs. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Nowruz, happy customs in Iran. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Feasts are the common feature of all cultures. Basically, a feast is a ceremony to pray and thank God for a victory or a great social event. Nowruz is an ancient national feast which has remained since thousands of years ago. It is rich in lofty human aspects. During Nowruz, many ceremonies are held throughout Iran. The first day of the solar year in Iran is the Feast of New Iranian Year. But it is not limited to Iran's geographical borders. It is celebrated in the vast area covering the entire regions of the Iranian culture. According to the statistics, at least 12 nations celebrate Nowruz, although each of them starts the feast according to their own national calendar. In addition to the nations within the domain of Nowruz culture, people in many countries celebrate Nowruz unofficially. India, Turkey, Egypt, France, Tatarstan in Russia, the United States, England, Canada, Netherlands, Germany, Lebanon, Syria, China, United Arab Emirates and Sweden are among these nations. Today we are going to talk about various happy customs in different regions in Iran during Nowruz days. Stay tuned, please. Among the commonest symbols of Nowruz are Haji Firuz and Amu Nowruz. These two itinerant figures go in different neighborhoods of cities and try to make people happy by singing very simple songs as a promise of the arrival of spring and Nowruz. Haji Firuz is a well-known figure in the Iranian folklore. He brings the message of arrival of Nowruz. He is usually a thin man who has blackened his face. He wears cone-shaped cap and red clothes with pointed shoes. Haji Firuz holds a tambourine at hand and playfully sings very simple folkloric songs on Nowruz. Another figure who may be seen on the streets in Iran is Amu Nowruz or Baba Nowruz. This figure comes with Haji Firuz and is the symbol of time. He is an old man with white hair and beard, wearing a blue silk belt, a white shawl, linen trousers, and light flat shoes. According to old tales, he comes from mountains toward cities with a stick in his hand. Amu Nowruz is the husband of Nane Sarma, and these two symbolize the turning of the old day to the new one. According to the old tales, Nane Sarma impatiently waits for the arrival of Amu Nowruz, but she falls asleep and wakes up only to see that Amu Nowruz has come and gone. Thus, she forgets about him till next year. Dear listeners, as I said, there are many ceremonies in different regions of Iran during Nowruz. For example, the people of East Azerbaijan, West Azerbaijan, and Ardabil provinces hold a special ceremony called Tokamchi. Tokam is a wooden effigy of a male goat. Tokamchi is the person who moves the effigy in the air while singing spring songs. According to the ancient Iranian text, goat is the symbol of ascension, solidity, and fertility. A tokamchi usually comes from the mountain and reads out poems on Nowruz and generation. The traditional saya is another ceremony which is held by Azeri people of Iran. Saya means respect, and it is held a few days before Nowruz. Sayachi is the person who holds the ceremony. He's usually an itinerant artist who wears colorful clothes and goes from village to village and reciting happy poems on spring and Nowruz, gives the tidings of the arrival of Nowruz while beating two wooden sticks in hand. People used to give them wheat, barley, sweets, and money. Iranian Kurds, too, have had ceremonies to mark Nowruz. Mir Nowruzi or Kusegardi was among the dramatic arts which used to be held among Kurds. Mir Nowruzi is a comic show in which a person is chosen as the governor or administer the affairs. Villagers would wear farcical masks and see off the main showman, meaning Kuse, and his bride. The Mir Nowruzi group would go from one house to another to give the good tidings of arrival of Nowruz while reciting poems. Usually, they would receive gifts for their performance. The people of Khorasan in eastern and northeastern Iran also hold Mir Nowruzi or Nowruz Khan ceremony in many villages and nomadic regions. Mir Nowruzi is a comic show in which a well-built man with neat clothes is symbolically chosen as the governor. He rides a horse and starts gathering taxes and gifts from villagers. Some people play local instruments and sing folkloric songs to accompany the show. At the end of Nowruz, that is 13th of Farvardin, the villagers play instruments while dropping the governor in a pond. Then they take him out and, while taking off his clothes, cause him to wear simple clothes and tell him that he is no more a Khan. Well, dear listeners, next episode, we will talk about other Nowruz ceremonies in Iran.
like steps with spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature. We here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Yemen, now in its seventh year, shows no signs of reaching a political resolve. But why? Why does Saudi Arabia continue a war that it is not winning on the ground? And why does the U.S. continue to support this war militarily? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Hossein Al-Bokhaiti joining us. He's an activist and political commentator who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Hamza Karim. He's a political commentator who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Hossein Al-Bokhaiti, let me first start with you, if I may. We're looking at a major attack that's taken place. It's not reported as such, but it really is a major attack. Drones that have hit the Saudi energy and water desalination facilities, looking at petroleum product distribution terminal in the southern Jizan region. I can go on with this list. It's quite an extensive list. Tell us the significance of this major attack. And what type of reaction mentally could Saudi Arabia be thinking of when it receives such a blow to its facilities?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think what the Saudi Arabia have now to do is to accept that they cannot continue with this war and to accept that Yemeni army is well equipped to target all Saudi oil infrastructure and power plant and as well as they did today, water treatment plant. Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has enforced a blockade on Yemen, killing hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians. And since Biden sworn as U.S. president, he realized that military action on Yemen against Sana'a forces has failed. That's why they have, for the last year, tightened their blockade, blocking fuel from entering Yemen. And this actually affects all water supplies and electricity supplies in Yemen. Many hospitals are running low in fuel, and there are a warning that they might be closing. And Yemeni army, when he has launched his first attack, they call it breaking the siege operation. And today we have seen three operations against Saudi Arabia, which target mainly and focused mainly on Saudi refinery and oil infrastructure, including power station. I think that Yemeni army now want to send a clear message to Saudi Arabia that the fire that that you have created in Yemen, the suffering of Yemeni civilians will be sent back to Saudi Arabia. But as well, we see on the top of all that, that all this attack that maybe it could be more than 40 ballistic missile and drone and drones and as well cruise missile has targeted Saudi Arabia. Not a single civilian was killed, and to show you the accuracy of these weapons used today. And as well, I want to mention that in all those three operations, they have used cruise missile, and we've seen in many footage released by some Saudi media showing some fire in some of those areas that was targeted. This shows that Yemeni army now has taken the decision to break the siege by attacking Saudi and by attacking their oil infrastructure, and they must stop, or they're going to see in the coming hours or days more attack against Saudi Arabia.
Okay, some good points made there, Hamza Karim, by our guest in Sana'a. In particular, what we're looking at, again, is the depth of the number of targets that the Yemeni army has hit. And our guest there talked about the precision. And that points to the fact that you're looking at the Yemeni army to have had major advancements in its arsenal throughout the years, this being one of them, which, again, it's surprising how it's not being reported. So if you take this attack and you cite all the different points, if you're Saudi Arabia, and then you take a look at, for example, the different accomplishments of Saudi Arabia, or should I say its mercenaries on the ground, you don't see a comparison that can be even made there, because the accomplishments by the Yemeni army far outweighs what Saudi Arabia has accomplished on the ground. Doesn't that point to a Saudi defeat, which requires a complete revamp of the way they're approaching this war militarily?
Absolutely, definitely. You know, if we look at the war for the past 7 years, Saudi Arabia have used all their cards in this war, engaging in really heavy military operations in Yemen in different front lines. After that, they started tightening the economy of Yemen by closing the airports and the ports. They've used all the cards in Yemen to try to accomplish any of the objectives that they announced when they started this war in 2015. But after 7 years, we see that none of these objectives were achieved. And I believe, right now what they're trying to do is basically try to tighten more the siege that is imposed on Yemen to really put pressure on people and human beings there in Yemen. So this shows that really they could not accomplish anything. And, if I were in Saudi Arabia or to advise them something, is that, they need to change the way that they're dealing with this war. I think after 7 years and not being able to achieve any militarily or political, achievements there, they need to start thinking about this war in a different way. They need to start engaging in serious peace talks with Ansarullah or the government in Sana'a. There need to be some serious actions on ground to show that really they're changing of the way that they're thinking about this war. But we see that they still continue doing what they've been doing for the past 7 years, and they don't seem to be learning from their mistakes and the way they're dealing with this war.
Okay, Hussein Abdelkhaiti, on the political front, there has been some movements made there by the UN. And I believe that you are of the opinion that the talks, which I believe were set to take place in Saudi Arabia, you believe that that is the wrong move, that Yemen should not participate in the country that's doing the bombing. Also, there's a point about the siege, where the last time around where there were political talks, the siege was a point of contention where the Yemeni government said, listen, lift the siege. And yet Saudi Arabia did not do that. Why is Saudi Arabia not lifting the siege before we talk about the political movements taking place?
It's clearly that they are using the humanitarian crisis and disaster on Yemen as a weapon. All the ships that are that should be actually arriving to Hodeidah, either fuel or food, they have been searched by the United Nations and as well by the Saudi coalition. And there is a United Nations team after a Hodeidah agreement in December 2018 in Stockholm. That team has been working in Hodeidah for over 2 years. But still, Saudi, because they have failed military, they think that using this humanitarian pressure, especially on fuel, which everything in Yemen and in any other country depend on fuel, they think as well in their media, they try to blame this shortages of fuel, to blame Sana'a government, because they think that they can deceive the Yemeni population. But on the other hand, we see that there are more people are joining the front line to fight Saudi Arabia. And as well, your first part of your question about the Saudi suggested to have talks in Riyadh, I don't think, and as well, Sana'a should not accept this, because they have refused, especially Ansarullah, to go to Saudi Arabia before the start of this war, because Saudi has been playing a dirty part in Yemen by supporting terrorism, by supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and supporting other group who have been targeting Yemeni civilians, either by suicide or by killing or kidnapping. That's why, I mean, it will be really, really impossible that the same country that has launched the war and you denied and refused to go in the first week of that war to talk in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia still consider what's happening in Yemen as a civil war. They think that they try to believe that they are not part of this war. And I think if Yemeni will accept that, this means that Saudi Arabia has won the war, because Saudi Arabia will not be obligated to pay any compensation for the killing of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni right. civilians, or for the destruction that's happening in Yemen. And I think one last thing, that when Saudi announced that they are ready to hold talks in Riyadh, I think because they know that the anniversary of the war, which is going to be on 26th of March, after maybe 10 days, they know that Yemeni army will launch a huge attack against Saudi Arabia. That's why they want to be to look like that they are the one who want peace. But I believe they don't want peace. They just want to make Yemeni civilians suffer. And now the responsibility is on Sana'a government to stop all that.
Well, we need to talk about this, because this is how this picture is being painted, Hamza Karim, in terms of how the media is wording the way that this war is taking place. And one of the things that is glaringly false is the following, where many media outlets say the violent struggle between Yemen's internationally recognized government, and I'm quoting, supported by a Saudi-led military coalition, and the Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Now, there are a couple of things here that are just false. When they talk about Yemen's internationally recognized governments, who is internationally recognizing this government is the first question, because when you look at what happened with elections, there was only one candidate, and that is not a criteria for a democratic election. And plus, when you talk about Abu Rabbah Mansur Hadi, most Yemenis don't recognize him as obviously their leader. Secondly, when they talk about this Iran-backed Houthi rebels, I mean, it's Iran does obviously support the Yemeni people. Why shouldn't it? They're being bombed. There is a harsh, severe humanitarian crisis. They're supporting that. But it kind of gives the idea militarily Iran is supporting Yemeni army and obviously the Nasrallah fighters. Why is this false narrative being, do you think, described in the way that it is?
Yeah, definitely. You know, Saudi Arabia and the international media outlets, they've been, since the war started in Yemen, they've been trying to position this war as a civil war between Yemeni parties. Now, there's definitely some internal problems between the Yemeni parties in Yemen, but this doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia is not playing the biggest role in this war. Without Saudi Arabia, this war would never have happened. When we're talking about the internationally recognized government, it's basically the government that really U.S. and Saudi Arabia wants to for them to be running Yemen. So Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi was elected in 2014 in a one-candidate election for 2 years, and then after 1 year, they extended their his presidency for another year. So basically, February 2015, Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi wasn't the president of Yemen, and the war was launched in March 2015. So even if we're talking about it from a legal perspective, he's not anymore the president. Now, when talking about Iran, now if you see Saudi Arabia, they've been supported by all the countries in the Western world. They've been buying arms from US, UK, France, Belgium, Germany, and a lot of other countries. How can you now, you know, try to convince Houthis that they cannot have partners and allies, but for them, they're Saudi Arabia has the right to deal with all the governments in the world when they want to impose on Ansar Allah and the government in Sana'a that they can't have partners and allies. This doesn't make any sense. Saudi Arabia can have their own allies. Yemen as well are allowed, and they have the right to decide who their allies should be.
Okay, Hossein Abukhaiti, the UN is trying very hard to make sure that talks take place. My question to you is, what type of talks can lead to any type of results or for the talks to be successful unless there is a party that the Saudi coalition or Saudi Arabia has in mind, somebody other than Abu Rabah Mansour Hadi that can be part of these talks? In other words, somebody that Yemenis also accept in order to, for there to be a compromise of any kind, if there is going to be one. So if they want to present Abu Rabah Mansour Hadi, how can the talks even lead to any type of success?
I mean, this is actually the problem, because when they call Hadi as the legitimate president or the legitimate government, Hadi he won an election. He was the only candidate. And I mean, if the United Nations actually want to help Yemeni and to reach a peace deal or to reach a talk, they should at the beginning. Accept that the Saudi is committing a war crime against Yemen by blocking food and fuel, by closing airport and port across Yemen, by preventing ships and fuel shipment to enter Yemen. I mean, this is a war crime. It doesn't matter who's in this war. And as well, they keep calling the war in Yemen, they call it as a Yemeni crisis or a civil war. So if the United Nations will not accept that Saudi Arabia is a major part in this war, and as well Sana'a forces, and as well other parties, and at that point, then Yemenis, I'm sure that they will accept any talk, but it should be in a country that is not involved in this war. They have suggested many months that Muscat or Oman could be that place, but why Saudi Arabia did not accept that? Because they want to make a win from any political talks to be held in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia actually want to make Yemeni feel that they are the one who opened Riyadh for them to reach a peace deal, and that they are the one who have struck this deal. But to be honest with you, the United Nations has been biased from the beginning of the war. And sure, as an example, the attack that has been taking place, as an example, on Sana'a many years ago, killing 1,000 Yemeni civilians on the Great Hall, Funeral Hall, United Nations has called it as an incident. And they have never, ever condemned Saudi Arabia. Okay. United Nations now, as well, is a biased, and they could not be part of any future deal.
All right. We have not talked about the U.S. here, which I'm going to ask you, Hamza Karim. What are we looking at when it comes to the U.S.? The media somewhat paints the picture now that they're somewhat confused as to what they're going to do. But when you take a look at the facts, arms sales continue. So what is the U.S. position in a minute, less than a minute, if you can say it?
Sure. You know, Saudi Arabia, this is their war in Yemen. U.S. is... This is the war of the U.S. in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is being used as a tool by this by U.S. We all remember in 2015 when the war started. It started from it was announced from the White House in Washington. Without the arms sales that and the logistics support and the intelligence support that Saudi Arabia is being given by U.S., this war wouldn't continue, okay, and Saudi Arabia wouldn't be able to defend itself. So definitely, you know, U.S. is playing the major role here in this war.
Thank you for that, Hamza Karim, political commentator from Toronto. Hossein Abukhaiti, many thanks, activist and political commentator from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
in the limelight.
The message sent to journalists could not be clearer or more chilling. What happened to Assange could happen to you too, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "The Hounding of Julian Assange Leaves Honest Journalism with No Refuge." Stay tuned for more. It's no accident that Julian Assange, the digital transparency activist and journalist who founded WikiLeaks to help whistleblowers tell Americans what Western governments are really up to in the shadows, has spent 10 years being progressively disappeared into those very same shadows. His treatment is a crime similar to those WikiLeaks exposed when it published just over a decade ago hundreds of thousands of leaked materials, documents we were never supposed to see, detailing war crimes committed by the United States and Britain in Iraq and Afghanistan. These two Western countries killed non-combatants and carried torture, not as they claimed, in the pursuit of self-defense or in the promotion of democracy, but to impose control over a strategic resource-rich region. It is the ultimate ugly paradox that Assange's legal and physical fate rest in the hands of two states that have the most to lose by allowing him to regain his freedom and publish more of the truth they want to keep concealed. By redefining his journalism as espionage, the basis for the U.S. extradition claim, they are determined to keep the genie stuffed in the bottle. In overturning a lower court decision that should have allowed Assange to walk free, the English High Court concerted to effectively keep Assange locked up indefinitely. He is a remand prisoner, found guilty of no crime, and yet he will continue rotting in solitary confinement for the foreseeable future, rarely seeing daylight or other human beings in Belmarsh, high-security prison alongside Britain's most dangerous criminals. The High Court decision forces our eyes off the ball once again. Assange and his supposed crime of seeking transparency and accountability has become the story rather than the crimes he exposed that were carried out by the U.S. to lay waste to whole regions and devastate the lives of millions. The goal is to stop the public conducting the debate Assange wanted to initiate through his journalism about Western state crimes. Instead, the public is being deflected into a debate his prosecutors want, whether Assange can ever safely be allowed out of his cell. Assange's lawyers are being diverted from the real issues too. They will now be tied up for years fighting endless re-argued actions, caught up in the search for legal technicalities, battling to win a hearing in any court they can to prevent his extradition to the United States to stand trial. The process itself has taken over, and while the legal minutiae are endlessly raked over, the substance of the case, that is the U.S. and Britain officials who ought to be held responsible for committing war crimes, will be glossed over. But it is worse than the legal injustices of Assange's case. There may be no hacksaws needed this time, but this is as visceral a crime against journalism as the dismemberment of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi by Saudi officials back in 2018.
and the outcome for Assange is only slightly less preordained than it was for Khashoggi when he entered the Saudi embassy in Istanbul. The goal for U.S. officials has always been about permanently disappearing Assange. They are indifferent about how that is achieved. If the legal avenue is a success, he will eventually head to the U.S., where he can be locked away for up to 175 years in severe solitary confinement in a supermax jail that is still until long past his death from natural causes. But there is every chance he will not survive that long. Last January, a British judge rejected extraditing Julian Assange to the U.S. over his suicide risk, and medical experts have warned that it will be only a matter of time before he succeeds. That was why the district court blocked extradition on humanitarian grounds. Those grounds were overturned by the High Court recently only because the U.S. offered assurances that measures would be in place to ensure Assange did not commit suicide. But Assange's lawyers pointed out those assurances were not enough to address concerns about his fragile mental health and high risk of suicide. These concerns should have been apparent to the High Court justices. There is no need to speculate about the Americans' bad faith. It is only too apparent in the myriad get-out clauses in the assurances they provided. Those assurances can be dropped, for example, if U.S. officials decide Assange is not being cooperative. The promises can and will be disregarded the moment they become an encumbrance in Washington's ability to keep Assange permanently silenced. But if losing the extradition battle is high stakes, so is the legal process itself. That could finish Assange off long before a decision is reached, as his fiancée Stella Morris indicated recently. She confirmed that Assange suffered a small stroke during a hearing in October in the endless extradition proceedings. There are indications he suffered neurological damage and is now on anti-stroke medication to try to stop a recurrence. Assange and his friends believe the stroke was brought on by the constant double strain of his solitary confinement in Belmarsh, an illegal process being conducted over his head in which he is barely allowed to participate. Niels Metzler, the United Nations expert on torture, has repeatedly warned that Assange has been subjected to prolonged psychological torture in the 9 years since he fled into Ecuador's embassy in London, seeking asylum from U.S. efforts to persecute him. That form of torture, Metzler has pointed out, was refined by the Nazis because it was found to be far more effective at breaking people than physical torture. Morris told the Daily Mail the stroke compounds our fears about Assange's ability to survive the longer this long legal battle goes on. Look at animals trapped in cages in a zoo. It cuts their life short. That's what's happening to Julian. And that indeed looks to be the price for U.S. officials that wanted him assassinated anyway. Whatever happens to Assange, the lawless U.S. security state wins. It either gets him behind bars forever, or it kills him quietly and quite lawfully, while everyone is distracted arguing about who Assange is rather what he exposed. In fact, with each twist and turn of the proceedings against Assange, we move further from the realities at the heart of the case towards narrative distractions. Who remembers now the first extradition hearings nearly 2 years ago, at which the court was reminded that the very treaty signed by Britain and the U.S., that is the basis 4. Assange's extradition explicitly excludes political cases of the kind being pursued by the U.S. against Assange. It is a victory for state criminality that the discussion has devolved to Assange's mental health rather than a substantive discussion of the treaty's misapplication to serve political ends. And similarly, the focus on U.S. assurances regarding Assange's well-being is intended to obscure the fact that a journalist's work is being criminalized as espionage for the first time under a hurriedly drafted, draconian, and discredited piece of First World War legislation, the 1917 Espionage Act. Because Assange is a political prisoner suffering political persecution, legal arguments are apparently powerless to save him. It is only a political campaign that can keep underscoring the sham nature of the charges he faces. What Assange bequeathed us through WikiLeaks was a harsh light capable of cutting through the lies of power and power of lies. He showed that Western governments claiming the moral high ground were actually committing crimes in the name of their people, out of sight, in far-off lands. He tore the mask off their hypocrisy. He showed that the many millions who took the streets in cities around the world in 2003 because they knew the US and UK would commit war crimes in Iraq were right to march. But he also confirmed something worse, that their opposition to the war was treated with utter contempt. The U.S. and the U.K. did not operate more carefully. They were not more respectful of human rights. They did not tread more lightly in Iraq because of those marches, because of the criticism beforehand. The Western war machine carried on regardless, crushing the lives of anyone who got caught up in its maw. Now, with Assange locked up and silenced, Western foreign policy can return comfortably to the era of zero accountability that existed before Assange shook up the whole system with his revelations. No journalist will dare to repeat what Assange did, not unless they are ready to spend the rest of their days behind bars. The message his abuse sends to others could not be clearer or more chilling. What happened to Assange could happen to you too. The truth is, journalism is already reeling from the combined assaults against Khashoggi and Assange. But the hounding of Assange strikes the bigger blow. It leaves honest journalism with no refuge, no sanctuary anywhere in the world.